Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting founder with a really inspiring story. You know, it's going to be a very inspiring episode, so brace yourself for it. You know, we're going to be talking about capital raising. You know, he's done it all the way through the Series B, you know, what has happened, you know, every step of the way, especially on the Series A. Also, how he was able to put himself in the position to be able to start this rocket ship that he's on. But again, all the good stuff that we like to hear when it comes down to building, scaling, financing, and beyond. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Armon Petrosyan. Welcome to the show.
Love it. What an intro. Thanks, Alejandro. Absolute pleasure to be here. Looking forward to this.
Born and raised in Portland, Oregon. Give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up, Armon?
Life was growing up great. I was a first generation American. Both my parents are Armenian, and grew up in Portland, Oregon. And it was a lovely upbringing, to be honest. I mean, it was a pretty standard upbringing, I would say. You know, I went to public schools through elementary, middle school, high school, and I loved being from Portland. I loved being from that area. It was a really great place to grow up.
I mean, it sounds like the entrepreneurial, you know, bug, you know, it kind of like was in you. I mean, where is this coming from? Is there like anyone in the family that is an entrepreneur? Like, where is this coming from?
Yeah, it's interesting. I would say my family lineage is pretty crazy. That being said, it is riddled with entrepreneurial spirit. And growing up, my father was a real estate broker. And so he was the hardest working person that I've ever seen and was his own kind of solopreneur, I would call it. He never had a team, but he was an incredibly effective realtor. And so I think even at a young age, observing him and how he went about his day to day and how serious he took his job was something that was instilled in me. And I always was passionate about entrepreneurship. Even as a little kid, I was selling candy in the treehouse in my backyard. And so, or at least to the neighborhood. And so there was always different things that I was trying to do to continue to enhance my entrepreneurial spirit. And a large part of that, I think, does come from your family and the people that you're surrounded by. So I was fortunate. I was very fortunate and grateful for that.
So you ended up going to the University of Oregon. And out of all things, you studied there business, Mandarin, Chinese, and, you know, finance, you know. So how do you find yourself all of a sudden in China, in Shanghai? Oh,
what an insane story. How I even ended up there in the first place is kind of ridiculous. I was in college. I was very interested in business, as you can imagine. And so I would do these informational interviews with anybody that was in my network that I thought was very successful in their career, which was usually my friend's parents. I think that might be a little strange. I was in high school and I would try to interview my friend's parents and understand what led to their success. And so one of the people I respected the most suggested that I learn a foreign language. And so I was like, okay, yeah, that sounds like a pretty good idea. That would separate myself as I go into the business world. I should learn a foreign language. And at the time, and you know, I think still to this day, China's a very quickly emerging market. And so he suggested Mandarin would be a good option. And I went back to college, or while I was in college later on, I pretty quickly made the decision that I'm going to go study abroad in China. And so I go to the study abroad office at University of Oregon. I walk in there with a ton of confidence. I go straight to the person at the front desk and I say, hey, I'm going to sign up to go to live in China for a year and study abroad there. And the person was like, okay, I'm looking at your curriculum of your history with classes. It looks like you've never taken a Mandarin class. So are you sure you want to sign up for a year there? And I was like, yeah, no, I'm sure. And they're like, have you done your research? Do you know what you're walking into? I said, you know, I've done some. And the lady suggests, why don't you go back and do a little bit more research and come back here once you've made up your mind? So a little bit frustrated. I go back to my place. I'm like, all right, fine. I'll go do some research. And I looked up, I pulled up my web browser, went to Google Images, and I typed in Shanghai, China. And I see these amazing pictures of the Bund in China. If you Google them now, you'd see it. This amazing skyline, super modern, high-tech looking skyline. It was in the James Bond movie. And I'm like, thinking back to it, I'm like, yeah, okay, I think I did my research. Closed the laptop. Next day, I walked back in, like, did extensive research. I'm ready to go. And so the lady's like, all right, well, if you do this, you do have to sign up for summer courses, learning Mandarin before you go. So I committed to it. And I do the 3 months intensive courses in Eugene, Oregon, where the U of O is. And I get on a plane. I ended up going to Europe in between for a couple months. And then I finally land in Shanghai. And my God, it was not what I saw in those Google Images pictures coming out of the airport. And I realized, like, at that moment, the term culture shock started to sink in. And I knew I was in for a ride for that next year as I saw things that I did not expect to see, whether it was smog, whether it was the infrastructure, whether it was the vehicles, you know, the energy, the just sheer population of people. And I, like I said, I knew I was in for a ride. I was a little nervous going into it. I was a little scared, but it ended up becoming probably the best lesson for me as an individual and one of the fastest or most growth experiences that I've shared with myself throughout my entire life being there for a year. So.
Well, during your university years too, I mean, you did quite some travel. I mean, not only China, you also were in Europe, you know, and you were bouncing from Amsterdam to Spain to Italy. So I guess all these travels, how do you think they opened up your worldview and the way that you, you know, the lens that you look at things from?
Yeah. So this was really the first time. So I was 20, turning 21 years old. And this was really the first time I had ever left the country or did any significant travel on my own as an individual. And I think growing up in Portland, Oregon, and going to college in Oregon, you're generally speaking going to know people. You're going to have mutual relationships with people anywhere you go. It's not uncommon to know people and have familiarity and have some level of identity with who you are. And it wasn't until I left where being in a foreign country with nobody that you know, no relationships, no pre-existing relationships, are you really forced to realize who you are as a person in the first place and start to understand and comprehend your own identity? And so going through that experience was one of the most illuminating things that brought me, it seems weird to say this, but brought me closer to myself and who I am. And also just exposed me to have to learn how to create relationships out of thin air and connect with people who I didn't have any pre-existing context with. And so that was very much emphasized living in China, where I knew nobody, or I guess not only did I not know anybody, I also had no idea what the culture was like. I had no idea how operations were run. There wasn't any familiarity. So it was a complete flip your world upside down moment. And I was obligated to kind of proceed and learn how to live my life in general and make friends and just manage all the other things that come with your life in a foreign country. So
eventually for you, you come back to the US and you become an intern to Warescape. And it sounds like that experience was quite life-changing.
It was, yeah. So basically, one thing that I felt really strongly about while I was in college and about to come out of college was I didn't really care what company I was going to go work for. I had a general idea that I was interested in software or tech and real estate, but I didn't really care as much what company I worked for specifically. I was so much more passionate about finding somebody who I could model my career after based on their skill sets and in some degree a mentor type figure. And so that was my focus. And there was a very specific person who happened to be at the company WearScape that I really wanted to work for, because my thinking was if I could obtain just half of their charisma, energy, thinking, communication skills, fill in the blank, that I'd be very successful in my career regardless of where I go. And so that just so happened to be in the ETL space or in the data analytics industry. And so I basically pitched him on bringing me on as an intern. And pretty quickly that became a thing. And as I worked there and was exposed to the analytics industry as a whole, and as the business continued to grow, I was fortunate to have a lot of experiences around touching every part of the business at WearScape, and was given a lot more responsibilities than I would say I was fully qualified for, which allowed me to step up and rise to certain occasions, which ultimately led to me falling in love with the analytics industry and the general space and building so many relationships, which are what led to us starting Coalesce. And so that unconventional path to founding a software company, I would say, was all driven purely based on the fact that I wanted to work for a specific person. Not that I had ever intended to get into data warehousing, data analytics, data engineering, into anything in that space. And I, looking back on it, was one of the best decisions I could have ever made.
So then let's talk about, starting the company. But obviously, just before, you did have something on the side, you know, that was like a nice kickstart into the whole entrepreneurial thing before you actually went full force, no? So what happened there with the Airbnb, you know, style, you know, side gig?
Yeah, good question. So basically, as I mentioned earlier, I've always been passionate about entrepreneurship. And when I was at WearScape, there was kind of two paths I saw the business unfolding. There was either one path where the existing organization stays the same and ends up taking on some investment and starts to move into the direction of building a next generation product, or something else would happen and there would be a different structure. It would get acquired or something would shift the gears where that wouldn't happen. And so my thinking was, I should build the financial freedom for myself so that way at some point, if the opportunity presented itself, I could pursue my own software company. And so the entire time I was there, I effectively found a unique code path to circumventing the regulations associated with short-term rentals in the city of Portland, where I was living, where I would buy homes and convert them into legal bed and breakfasts and advertise them on Airbnb. And so that became a really awesome side hustle for me. It also helped me operate a business as a solopreneur. And so that thought, that kind of self-awareness for me at least, allowed me to be in the position where I had the financial freedom to not let the opportunity cost of starting a business and not being able to pay a salary to myself allow me to go and pursue what became Coalesce later. And there's some people in this world who can go and, you know, pursue a company and, you know, kind of like live in a shoebox, or maybe they have a different setup where money isn't a problem and they can start a company and not be stressed out. Whereas for me, I felt very strongly that if I didn't have a standard of living that allowed me to think clearly and make decisions the way that I wanted to, then I wouldn't be in the right position to pursue a company, or at least I wouldn't make the right decisions. So it was really critical that I set up some type of foundation that would allow me to maintain the standard of living that I wanted while I would pursue something that would initially be more risky, quote unquote. So,
hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then let's talk about pursuing the more risky, quote unquote, with Qualys. So talk to us about how was that incubation process, you know, from the moment that one day you got the idea to when the moment that you were like, okay, let's go, let's do it.
Yeah. So my co-founder and I, we were incredibly fortunate because we worked together. At this point, we've worked together for almost a decade. And we were exposed to such a large volume of massive scale data warehouse implementations at our previous company, Warescape. And there we learned about the core concept of what could actually solve these very common breaking points that you only see as you pass the threshold of being literally the world, like some of the world's largest, most complex data warehouse or data engineering projects. And so we were staring these problems in the face and a solution in the face over and over and over again all day. And as that was happening, the core team there always fantasized about being able to take a concept, take all the learnings we had of dealing with these massive scale implementations and start from scratch and build a cloud native solution focused on solving the problem, which is the biggest bottleneck in analytics today and where Qualys serves, which is the data transformation component. And so as that company, Warescape, was gaining more momentum, we ended up getting acquired. And it became clear that what we wanted to accomplish was not going to happen at that company. And that exact same night, I got a phone call from Satish. And he was like, dude, this is our chance. We've got all the relationships in the industry. We've got a crystal clear vision of what we need to build. We've got relationships with partners, customers, a go-to-market team. All we need to do is put pen to paper. And so pretty quickly we left. We went straight into stealth and got working. And we were so lucky because we were able to skip the ideation phase of a typical startup and the whole find product market fit phase, largely because we had so much exposure to the exact space that we wanted to build a product in and so many relationships in that space. And so when I hear about founders who, I have so much great respect for founders who go through the process of finding product market fit, and that can oftentimes take many years. Whereas for us, we were able to shave off several years of our company journey because we had so much clarity on what we wanted to accomplish. And so that was the genesis for us building what is Qualys today and what's led us to have such quick growth in what's typically a very competitive industry.
So talk to us about the you know, the business model. How do you guys make money?
Yeah, so we're a software product, and we effectively help data engineers be exponentially more productive compared to any other alternative in the industry. And so customers buy our product as a developer solution, and will pay an annual subscription or a multi-year subscription to license our product and use it every day when it comes to delivering their Snowflake data projects.
So then also, what was that journey like of raising money? Because I know that you guys have raised quite a bit of money. How much capital have you guys raised today?
81 million, I think is the exact number. It's probably close to that.
And you guys have done a couple of rounds. So how has it been to going from one financing cycle to the next with the company?
Every cycle has been crazy, I would say. They've all been very different. And so the first round we ever raised was a angels round and like angel investors or family and friends round, whatever you want to call it. And this was one of the biggest challenges for me because, you know, again, I grew up, I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon. I had no connections to the venture capital industry or financial institutions or any type of investors that were focused on high growth startups. And so for me, it was all about figuring out those relationships. And fortunately, because there was a lot of people that both my co-founder and I were close with that knew the problem area that we were going after solving, we were able to raise roughly $1 million from close connections and people who believed in what we were going to build because they had seen the problem firsthand. And so that gave us a little bit of fuel to build our minimum viable product that we could then go and kind of shop to potential customers. But it wasn't until I moved to San Francisco just over 3 years ago to actually start the fundraising process of going venture capital backed. And me walking into that, I mean, I moved here knowing pretty much nobody, having zero relationships in the venture capital industry and had to start from scratch and figure it out. And that whole journey has been, it's been a crazy one. It's been a super fun one. And it's obviously been a successful one so far. So that was a big move for me, was actually uprooting myself and moving out here with that vision in mind. I just had a feeling that this would be the right place to be to do it.
You were talking about figuring out the venture capital world. What have you figured out? You know, having a Series B in already and having raised, you know, the $80 million plus. What have you figured out so far that has impressed you the most?
Yeah. So I would say that it's been going through several rounds now. So we did our seed, our Series A, and our Series B. There was a lot of learnings in every round. And I would say, I don't know if there's anything that's necessarily impressed me the most, but from the learnings, it was incredibly eye-opening to go through the fundraising process and meet so many different venture capital firms and understand what the process looks like and how different it was from my expectations. And so I had a completely misrepresented idea of what fundraising should be and how it goes. And there were so many learnings going through the past three rounds that I would say I would have never known unless I actually did it or at least spoke to somebody who had been there and done that. But I would say the biggest things I've learned at the end of the day is there are a ton of investors out there. There are firms that have really flashy, sexy brands to them that we're all familiar with. And then there's other firms that don't have as well-known brands. And for whatever reason, we seem to think that because there's a strong brand associated with the venture capital firm, that they must have the sharpest, most knowledgeable, strongest people at those businesses. And me going through the process of talking to every single one of them in this area, I've learned is completely false. My initial perception of it was completely false. There are so many firms that disappointed me that I spoke to, that I came into starry-eyed thinking they were going to be the most knowledgeable, best investors I could have ever found. And then there's been so many firms that have just absolutely impressed me that I would have never expected to be what they were. And so it's that whole process was illuminating as a founder and as an entrepreneur.
So in this case, you know, for you, I mean, obviously when you raise money, it needs to come with a vision, right? Because they're betting on a vision, these investors, and you have like great investors. So I guess as you're thinking about that vision, you know, that got excited, you know, into the future that you're living into, the investors, the employees, If I was to ask you, you know, let's say you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Qualys is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so pretty much since the history of analytics was even started, there has been so many flaws in the process. I would say a lot of them are being solved, but the biggest issue in the analytics industry today is the process of taking data once it's landed in its raw format and getting it to the point that it's consumable in a way that has proper governance, has proper documentation, has minimal technical debt, and has traceability or lineage is a common term in the industry. And there is a fractured approach. There's a fractured architecture of different technologies for people of varying technical skill sets. And as a result, there isn't any clarity. There isn't any holistic view of what goes on in the manufacturing or assembly line of taking the parts, if you will, the data, and getting it to the final product. And so, assuming this vision, our vision, has been fully realized at Qualys, what you would see is organizations that can actually produce data at a rate that is faster than the consumers of data could ever possibly imagine, and that there is visibility into how things were built, what was built, with a level of modularity and standardization that allows for them to make changes quickly in a world where analytics projects then flourish and insights are available at the snap of a finger for any decision that anybody would want to make when driving their companies forward.
So we're talking about the future here, but I want to talk about the past and do so with a lens of reflection, because I mean, you guys have been pushing this for now, you know, close to 4 years. So if I was to put you into a time machine, Armon, and I bring you back in time to maybe that moment where you guys were like, screw it, let's do it, you know, kind of thing. And you're able to stop that younger, you know, self and give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
If I were to be able to go back in time and give myself some advice right before any of this, I think the most important thing that I would share with my younger self would be to build habits, seriously be disciplined about building habits that allow you to manage all levels of your life in a way that's healthy and sustainable. Whether that's exercise, whether that's your mental health, whether that's physical recovery, whether that's your diet, food, whether that's fun and things that you want to enjoy, experiences you want to enjoy, figure out those habits, figure out those systems, and focus on them like it's do or die. Because those habits, that foundation, is what allows you to go through the absolute roller coaster journey of starting a company. And without them, you're going to be in a much, much more difficult situation. And you may not wake up every morning and love what you're doing and be excited. There is a lot of work that goes into this. And the most important piece is building the right foundation, the right systems for you to be successful.
I love it. Armon, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
I'm super active on LinkedIn. We do LinkedIn Lives, webinars. I'm pretty easy to reach. Just find me on LinkedIn if you want to touch base. It's pretty simple to find me and connect with me shoot me a follow. And if there's ever anything that people want or any questions they have about the interview, I'm happy to answer. So yeah, feel free to reach out.
Amazing. Well, hey, Armon, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thanks, Alejandro. The honor is mine. The pleasure is mine, man. This was great. I had a lot of fun.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.